It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
Talking about science fiction from the Emerald Isle.
I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
And we have a whole bunch of special guests today. We have, in order, we have Gareth Kavanaugh. Hello, Gareth.
Hello, Sean.
Want to say a little bit about yourself?
My name is Gareth Kavanaugh. I am currently the chairperson for OCTCOM, which is the Irish National Science Fiction Convention, which takes place next year in October. And I'm currently involved in the bid to bring Worldcon to Dublin, Ireland in 2019.
Excellent, excellent. Our other guest is Ruth Frances Long. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm Ruth Frances Long. I write mainly for young adults these days, occasionally for adults as RF Long, and I write about scary fairies.
Yes, you do. Your fairies are terrifying. Our other guest is Michael Carroll. Hello, Michael.
Hello. I'm a writer. I write Judge Dredd for 2018 and Judge Dredd Magazine. I've also written Jennifer Blood for Dynamite Comics, but mostly I write novels, chiefly being the young adult superhero series, Quantum Prophecy, of which not nearly enough copies have been sold yet.
We'll work on that for you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And our last guest is Maura McHugh. Hello, Maura.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm still breathing.
That's great.
How about you?
Yeah, pretty good after our loss of an hour. It's not too bad now. Still
right.
a bit darker, but still beautiful in Ireland.
In case for the American listeners, that the folks over in Ireland have already turned back their clocks, so we've got a little bit more time, but you guys are actually already got your hour, so I'm sure it's very strange.
Part of the problem here is that we've turned the clocks back to 1973. I still don't understand this, whether it goes back or forwards or up or down. And I just have to look at the clock and believe it. So, it's too hard.
Yeah, it's all automatic these days, which is fantastic.
Yeah. It's rubbish.
Well, Maura, would you want to tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name is Maura McHugh. I write prose and comics. Currently finished up on Witchfinder, which I co-wrote with Kim Newman for Dark Horse Comics. It's part of the Mike Mignola universe. I've also write short stories. I've done play. I'm also on juries, stuff like that. Lots of different things, different pies, lots of fingers.
I like pie.
Who doesn't?
Weird people don't like pie. That's who doesn't like pie. All right. Yeah. That might be really awkward if somebody on here doesn't actually like pie. That would make that a very strange conversation. So to start off, because Gareth helped us set this up in terms of suggesting folks it would be great to do this podcast with. And I know Gareth because I met him at Worldcon in San Antonio and know that about his involvement in fandom. So I wanted to start with talking about fandom in Ireland. And we'll start with you, Gareth, to kind of talk about you know, the size and the feel of what fandom is like in Ireland.
Well, basically, fandom, the literary fandom is a reasonably sized event for Europe and similar, not on the scale of American events. So you tend to get much more personal events, 200-300 people events where people are able to interact more freely. Then you start having stuff like the anime events and the general geek events, which start hitting up into the 500, 600, 700 pay mark, and some of the anime events are hitting around 2,000 people. We then also have a large number of gaming events, which are separate from that again, standalone events, which hit around the 500 person mark. There's also regular meetings on various different groups in various different parts of the country.
Excellent, excellent. So you're involved in two bids you've already mentioned, and the Dublin bid for Worldcon is one that I suspect our listeners are very familiar with because I probably mentioned it at some point. Could you tell us a little bit about the process of like, you know, A is sort of the process of how you're dealing with this I'm just going to make a big circular argument by saying how you're dealing with this process. That's not what I mean. God. A, the kind of the process of doing that, of putting together a Worldcon bid, but also what people can expect from this in the event that it wins, the kind of because, for example, that if people have seen the location for it is gorgeous, for one.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that was part of it. For a long time, there wasn't a venue in Ireland that would be possible to host a Worldcon. At least there was a couple of venues that could have them, but they'd be very much big, echoey halls, wouldn't be very good for hosting. So when the conference center was finished, that was a real big plus in starting to do it. And we started to investigate that matter. And so over a few years, we built a relationship with the conference center and started putting together a proposal and similar. And we launched a kind of pre-bid in San Antonio to let people know what we intended to do, and we saw how the reaction was. It was generally a very positive reaction, so we decided that that was definitely a good sign that we should proceed. So we formally launched our bid at LungCon. We were taking pre-supports, friends and similar, and we got over 450 people taking some form of support in that way. So at this point, we're basically just making sure we have a proper bid committee together, you know, because there's three parts we have to focus on. We want to focus on America for the normal Worldcon group. Then we want to have a focus on Europe to make sure, you know, we are in Europe. We need to get a focus on Europe. We also want to have a focus in Ireland as well, because Irish fandom, by and large, there's a lot of people who probably wouldn't have been to Worldcon or have heard of Worldcon. We want to try and get them involved as well from the bid stage and hopefully, if we win, going on from there. I mean, we're all basically building up towards the vote, which will hopefully, which will take place in 2017 in one of the various places that are currently bidding for the 2017 Worldcon.
So, I know that the London Worldcon had record attendance this last year. Do you think that if Ireland wins this bid, you'll be looking at a similar giant number of attendees?
We don't. That is the one issue with the venue, is there is actually a size limit that we probably wouldn't be able to exceed. They say, we're looking at 4,000 or 5,000 people, depending on how things are looking. So that is one of the issues with the venues, that it does actually mean we're only going to have that kind of a level of membership.
Huh. Well, I mean, 4,000 to 5,000 is still a lot of darn people, though.
Oh, absolutely. But it's just when you compare to LungCon, though it should be noted that that LungCon 10,000 person figure includes the supporting members. I think their actual on-the-door numbers were around 7. I could be wrong on that. No, hopefully not too wrong, but there were about 7,000 people through the door.
Hmm. And that, so, that also was
Which is still still pretty large convention. Probably it's, as far as I'm aware, it's, if it's not the largest, it's second largest.
Yeah, it's, and you also got to remember too that it wasn't actually in the sort of central part of London. It was sort of way out on the outside in that enormous convention center, which we didn't even, like, we filled like one corner of that center. That thing was like a mile, bazillion miles long. So,
yes. You know, some of us walked it every day.
Yes.
Whereas so, in this case, our convention center is actually only about a mile from the city center. You can walk from the convention center down from there as far as basically O'Connell Street, which is the central street of Dublin.
So I would like to switch focus from just the straight fandom side to start talking to those of you that are authors who may have a somewhat different relationship. You may have also begun as just straight fans, as I know some of you have. And we'll start with you, Ruth, to talk about your relationship with fandom, both before you became an author and afterwards.
Well, yes, I think as with the others, I started off as a fan. So I was certainly writing by the time I went to my first convention here, but I don't think I'd had anything published. So it's certainly a space I feel very happy in and very comfortable in. I find the Irish conventions are very much, we can sit down and have a chat and we can go to the bar together and we can, everyone's there because they passionately love something. And I think that's really important. And a great atmosphere there.
Excellent. So, what would, from your perspective, what is Irish SF fandom like? Gareth was kind of suggesting that there is a kind of vibrant community, but from your perspective, what is your interaction with fans actually like as a writer?
Well, very positive. Ireland as a space is known for its writers anyway. So there's tremendous support from both other writers and from the fans themselves, and an awful lot of the people I would be interacting with will have some, there's an awful lot of input into it, whether it's through art or writing or through costume or anything like that. People get very involved in fandom here, and it's super. It's a lovely, lovely atmosphere and very, very friendly.
Excellent. Well, what about you, Michael, since we're kind of going down the line here? What about your take? And obviously you may have a somewhat different relationship in the same way as Maura, since you also do comics.
Yeah, I started out as a fan, as most of us do, involved in the Irish Science Fiction Association, which was around back in the late 80s. And then sort of gradually, I don't know, I won't say rose through the ranks, but I developed on the path of becoming a professional. But yeah, the conventions and the whole sort of fan scene here is very, very strong. And I don't know what it's like in other countries, but it is very, the events tend to be quite small and quite intimate here. So okay, that's not true. Lately we have been getting some of the big commercial conventions and such where, you know, you have to pay for autographs and stuff like that, which to be honest, I find quite abhorrent. But, in general, yeah, going on to convention like OctoCon or PCon or ArcadeCon or Dice or something, just go along and you just chat to the creators, just, you know, have a very relaxed, next time. So it is very informal, I think. And, there's a lot of encouragement, for new upcoming people. For some reason, we seem to be incapable of putting the stick into the spokes of people who are wheeling up behind us, which is not fair, because we should be able to discourage other writers and artists, because they're going to be stealing food from the mouths of our children somewhere down the road, you know? And so we need to make sure that these people are discouraged at all times. We need to unite against about this, you know? But in general, there's a lot of encouragement. I mean, I got my big start by... I got to know an Irish writer called Michael Scott back in, second OctoCon would have been the year 1991. And I remember saying to him, oh, I've always wanted to write a book. And he says, well, why don't you? Quite abruptly, I went, no. And I realized, of course, that it was the correct approach. You know, we can talk about writing, but that's not the same as writing. And in subsequent years, I've done the same to other people, encouraged them to actually follow their dreams rather than just dreaming their dreams. So there's a lot of great feedback we get like that, I think.
Excellent. And what about you, Maura?
Yeah, very similar. I started out as a fan, someone who thought a lot about writing, didn't actually write, or did some, but not very consistently. And I was involved in running Octocons back in the day and got to know the fan scene very well. It's quite small. I mean, it's changed quite a lot now because it's diversified. I think originally there was only pretty much OctoCon and GaleCon, which is a gaming convention, and the gaming conventions, and there are other gaming conventions in universities around Ireland. They always sort of kept kind of separate. There were people that went to both, but they're often quite diverse, but quite distinct, I should say, distinct audiences. But as time has gone on now in Ireland, we've had way more conventions. So you've got ones that focus on comic books, ones that are more anime, multimedia, and they're all doing really well. And I go to quite a number of them and really enjoy them. And then as I went on, and became, I don't know, little less insecure and more interested in and more confident in writing, then I started writing and getting my work published. And the people here have always been incredibly supportive. You know, the Irish scene is quite small, even though now it's become, there are many distinct different types of conventions, but they've always been very supportive of people. It's been great. And, I still am somewhat involved in con running in that, James Bacon, who ran the program, all of the program for Worldcon in London this year, he actually asked me, we used to run cons together, he asked me to do the comic book programming for Worldcon, which is maybe the first time there's been a very distinct comic book programming going on in Worldcon, because comic books are still kind of new to the Worldcon audience. I think the Hugo only started in about 2009. So, and I also co-run Ladies Do Comics with Linda Rucker, who's a horror writer who lives in Ireland. So I'm still, even though I'm a writer and now, I also still keep my hand in events, running events, and I go to a lot of cons and meet people. And I really enjoy that whole scene, because even though I'm a writer, I am still a fan of the media.
Excellent, excellent. So to switch gears a little bit, to actually to kind of dovetail off of what Maura had said at the end there about not just the media, but in terms of the actual production. So I know that when we last tried this episode, we had talked a little bit about the sort of thematic elements that exist in Irish SF, and I believe, Ruth, that you had suggested that there's a kind of a folkloric component to much of Irish writing, and I was hoping we could start with you to have you actually talk about that issue once we get Gareth back. I'll rephrase that question, because that was poorly worded.
Sorry, but
are you back?
Sorry about that.
Me time to think.
Okay, so let me just—I'll rephrase it. I'm sorry. So, Julie, will you count the number thingy so I can see it again in the audio?
Sure.
Sorry about that.
It's okay. Right. It's okay. It happens.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So to switch gears just a little bit to kind of, and I'll start with you, Ruth, to talk about some of the thematic elements that are part of Irish SF, the written SF, or in other, obviously other kinds of forms like media SF, etc. And I know that the last time we had attempted this episode and I screwed up and was a terrible human being, you had mentioned that there's a kind of folkloric quality to a lot of written SF, and I was hoping we could start with you to have you talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I think Irish folklore is still very much alive and immediate to us, in that we're a nation of storytellers anyway, and that is essentially what folklore to me is. It's stories that people tell each other. So rather than the sort of grand mythology, we have the stories of that creepy hill over there and what happens there on Halloween night. And it's all very immediate and next door. So I think our sense of the supernatural is quite close to our daily lives still. It partly, I think, comes from a largely rural background as well. And yeah, I mean, it's something that, it permeates all sorts of different stories, that happen here. I think you find it, in an awful lot of our writers' work, that it's very much there still. I'm not sure what else to say on that. The others may have some ideas as well.
Sure. Well, why don't we jump to, jump to you, Maura.
Yeah, I think the storytelling element is extremely strong here, and I think there is a sense of in Ireland, because of our folklore tradition and our mythological tradition, there is a sense of just around the corner something different could be there. And I think that translates into science fiction as well as fantasy and horror. And you'll notice that even though we have, you know, many good SF and, shall we say, speculative fiction writers, people who write in an unreal tradition, we also have plenty of writers who would seem to be mainstream and yet have done infused their writing with this sense of the otherworldly. So it's almost as if we can't really do something straightforward. We have to go around the corners and do something odd with writing. And also we have a very interesting relationship with the English language, I think, because it isn't our, essentially it's not our first language, you know, but we have co-opted and we have colonized English back to make it our own. And I think that makes for some really interesting use of English, colorful. And, so, you know, I mean, you'll see that in a lot of writers, especially when you look at the likes of even Joyce, you know, Beckett, who are considered again mainstream writers, and yet we're doing some very strange, absurd or surreal things. Flann O'Brien's At Swim Two Birds, you know, there's and these are just these are mainstream writers. And then, you know, we have people who are writing in the supernatural tradition in the, you know, going way back at the beginning of the 19th century. You'd have Charles Maturin, then you have Sheridan Le Fanu, you have Bram Stoker, who wrote Dracula, which is, we've just had the Bram Stoker Festival going on in Dublin. Dracula, which they say to be the most published book other than the Bible. So, and then if you move that into the 20th century, you've got, you know, tons and tons of people writing, both in science fiction, fantasy. We have amazing range of, young adult writers in particular who are doing extremely well outside of the country. So yeah, it's a really, you know, I think this infuses us as a country. We love to talk. We love to tell stories. And that you can see that really well represented among our writers.
Excellent, excellent. So, Michael, did you have a perspective on any of this?
No.
Nope.
No, I do. I think Maura's right. Everybody's right. We have a tradition of storytelling over here. To be honest, I could talk for hours and hours and hours on this podcast about nothing and it still wouldn't be finished because I can talk forever. It is something that we like to do, possibly, as Maura says, because officially we grow up bilingually almost. Well, we're supposedly bilingual. Almost nobody actually speaks the Irish language because it's hard and horrible. But we do have that relationship, that odd relationship with words. We're supposed to have the gift of the gab, as they say. But actually, generally, I think that's just self promotion, which I'm very good at too. So, but I think we have a I don't know, like a lot of nations, the Irish like to think of themselves as being special and somehow selected, and that, you know, we're that little bit above everybody else. But in reality, you know, we're all just storytellers. And that's not disparaging anyway, because that's, you know, that's the good thing about us. We are great storytellers over here, I think. I mean, we only have to look at the people on this podcast, excluding myself. I mean, Ruth and Maura are two of my favorite writers, and I happen to know them, so I'm lucky. But there are some very, very good, very, very good entertainers, not just storytellers, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not just about getting a story across. It's about involving the listeners in an adventure, bringing them with you. And, that's something that I think we're quite good at. I mean, other nations are sure are good at it too, but they probably aren't as good looking as we are. So, you know,
yeah, I think I was saying the last time, sorry, I'm not meaning to cut across you, Michael. We can't just tell a story about, you can't just say, I was coming into town and my bus broke down. It has to develop as a story.
So yes.
By the time you get and meet your friends, you're like, well, the whole thing started shaking and there was smoke billowing out of the front and I thought, oh God, it's going to go on fire. But then it didn't. And like the bus driver was yelling down the line to the center and saying, and they were going, no, there's no other buses around. And then we were all going to have to stand on the edge of the road, and it goes on. But that's what everyone expects. I mean, you can't just go, my bus broke down, and everybody goes, and then what happened? You go, well, I got another bus, it was fine.
Well, it is a great tradition of adding drama to a story. I have a friend who actually is known to most of the other people on this cluster who will, when she's telling a story, will say, well, and he turned around to me and said blah, 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 and I turned around to him, and he turned around to me, and I turned around to him. And I always picture her on a little roundabout or some sort of turntable going around in little circles. But we do, we hype up our own tales and our own adventures, not for self-aggrandizement or aggrandizing, not for, not to promote ourselves, I don't know that word, but mainly to, just to entertain the listener, yeah. I think.
Yep.
I mean, that might be a superficial approach, but it seems to be the case.
Excellent. Gareth, I haven't got your thoughts on this. Do you have any thoughts on these particular things? Anything anyone said?
I think that there's a lot of truth in there that, you know, a lot of the stories we tell are based on our folklore, but then we also have other events that have happened in Ireland over the ages that we still remember and still are reflected. You have, you know, things where large numbers of Irish people have left and gone elsewhere, and how that's, you know, affects people left behind, never mind how that's affected countries they've gone to. And these are all, you know, they're not always obvious in the stories, but you'll see it in some stories, how they're reflected out. So it's not always the big themes in stories, but the little themes are always there as well if you just keep an eye on them.
Yeah, that does raise another interesting thing, which is, you know, there's a huge Irish diaspora, you know, but people have moved, you know, historically, or they're descended, you know, their great grandparents moved to America or something, like from Ireland or whatever in, you know, 1910. And obviously the opposite way, we have, I know, Ruth, you had mentioned before that a great number of people have actually come to Ireland, just they've just gone and become writers within Ireland and have sort of been adopted as part of the Irish writing scene because of where they've sort of become centralized. So expatriate writers, and in some respect, both directions, just having very different relationships. I mean, does anyone have any thoughts on the sort of the folks that actually have come to Ireland and just become a part of the writing scene, who are from elsewhere?
Well, they're great. To be honest, luckily for us, most of the people who come here are pretty cool people. And I think partly because to make that big change, to just move to another country, you know, you have to be quite adventurous to do that. And I think Irish people, because we're used to having to do that normally to leave Ireland, like I've lived abroad, you know, that we are always quite enthusiastic when somebody actually wants to come and live in Ireland. But also, one of the main reasons is that there was a tax initiative that was brought into Ireland, which allowed people who were creative, as in they were artists, and artists includes writers, playwrights, poets, artists who draw, all of that, musicians, their income that they made from their creative endeavor was tax free. And now that's changed in the last few years. It used to be there was no limit to how much money you could ask for tax free. Now the limit is 50,000 euros, which is quite acceptable for most writers, since in Ireland, the official number is that most writers make less than 10,000 a year, the majority. So I can tell you it's a very, very useful tax incentive, because what it does is it recognizes that the creative life requires, like, you know, up to 10, 15 years to get off the ground. It's a long process. So, you know, we've had a tradition here now of bringing loads of accepting and introducing and encouraging writers from all over the world. People who used to live here, which were quite well known, would have been Anne McCaffrey, for instance. She lived in Ireland the majority, actually, of her life. You know, as an old friend of Michael Carroll's, Harry Harrison lived here for a long time. And then you've got Morgan Llewellyn, Diane Duane, Peter is from Northern Ireland, Peter Morwood. And then recently we've got the likes of C.E. Murphy, Linda Rucker, who I mentioned already. I'm just trying to think who else is among us.
I don't know. Yes, many, many, many wonderful people have.
Oh, what's her name? Oh gosh, it's gone out of my head completely. We mentioned it at the last one. There are more actually.
But it's very enriching for us as well, I think, as writers, to have, you know, other people to bounce ideas off with different perspectives. And as Maura says, they tend to be really lovely people that we get along with, so that's good.
So I have a question, sort of bouncing off of this, because Sean mentioned that there is a giant Irish diaspora where people who have left Ireland over the course of the last 200 years have settled all over the place, but there are a lot of Irish descended people in the United States, and some cities, specifically Chicago and Boston especially, have a lot of Irish pride. So I think that there are a lot of Americans who really have no living memory of being in Ireland, but feel very, very connected to it. And I'm wondering how you guys feel about all of that, because in some ways it's very disconnected. Like, for instance, I live in Boston. So our sports teams, we have a basketball team, which in America is pronounced the Celtics. That's spelled C-E-L-T-I-C-S, and it has a shamrock as the mascot, and their colors are green and white. And they're basketball players, and a lot of them are African-American, because that's a lot of basketball players in the United States are. But yet, because of coming from the history of having a lot of Irish immigrants and having this Irish pride, that's a Boston sports team. And I think that there's a lot of disconnect here about that. But I'm wondering how that feels to you guys coming from the place where you didn't leave and you're still there.
I'm not going to say anything on this, because last time we recorded this, or attempted to record this podcast, I ranted for a good half hour. I'm not sure. You might all remember this. Well, okay. I will briefly say that, yeah, there's a lot of wannabe Irish who, people whose ancestors were Irish, who still think that they have a connection to the old country. And they can be interesting and fun and dangerous and so on, you know, dangerous when they support paramilitary organizations under the belief that they're helping to free a country that's beleaguered. But in general, yeah, you know, I mean, it's nice to have some sort of Irish pride. But years ago, I was in New York, myself and my wife were over there for a holiday, and we went into an Irish store, and the guy didn't recognize our accents. Because he thought we would all talk like Joe Vertilli and Chalo Hal, or like Michael Fox in Back to the Future when he did the Irish ancestor of the McFlys. Nobody talks like that. So, yeah. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I mean, I'm actually I was born in the States and by Irish immigrants, and then returned to Ireland, and I've lived in Ireland and I've lived in the US. So I think the thing is that identity is a burning issue in the States, and where you come from is very important. And I think for people who live in Ireland and have no issue of you know, who they are, because a lot of the time it's pretty self-evident who they are and they've been here a long time, it might seem strange that, this is now, I'm talking about America, have a particular identity, you know, where they, even though they're generations removed, they still do feel genuinely quite strongly connected to Ireland. And I think that's great. And I have many relatives in the US because the majority of my parents' family have emigrated there. So, I mean, I see this all the time. I was just back in New York and, but it's, you know, I think obviously their version of Ireland is not our version of Ireland. They're actually, it's a concept of Ireland, for a lot of people. While for us, it's a lived reality of Ireland. And the other thing is that there's been, I mean, I cannot describe to you the spectacular change in Ireland in the last 20 years, and quite frankly, a lot of it for the good. And I think the problem is that for some people, not all people, some Irish Americans, their concept of Ireland is now well behind the time of what our lived reality of Ireland is.
Well said.
What about you, Gareth?
I generally agree with Maura that by and large, you know, I have family in America as well who've gone over there. People, to a certain extent, I think it's almost a reflection on America that people don't identify themselves as American, they're Irish American. Mm. I think to a certain extent, I have no problem with someone being
American from with Irish ancestry and being absolutely aware of their Irish ancestry, but they have to be aware that we're a country that isn't as represented by various Hollywood movies with leprechauns and John Wayne and so on. We are a country that has, to a large extent, become a very modern economy. We have, you know, cars, we have these things, but sometimes you're talking to people who, I don't know what their impression of Ireland is, but they seem almost disappointed that they're not met at the airport with a horse and carriage. And maybe we should start doing that to get them to come over and give us some money. But, you know, I mean, I think it's a respect thing that you kind of have to be aware that what you think of what someone else is isn't what necessarily they are. If that makes a bit of sense.
It definitely does. And I like how you made a reference to John Wayne, and I'm guessing you're referring to The Quiet Man.
Yes.
In which an Irish American returns to Ireland and hijinks ensue. In which he apparently learns that in order to be Irish, he has to smack women and fight their brothers.
And tell her to get back in the house.
Yes.
It's a horrible movie. But when that came out, my parents were, they were fairly young, and they, my mother was telling me that it was a huge deal because it was the first major movie made in Ireland, the first sort of proper Hollywood representation of Irish people that wasn't just cops or drunks. I mean, they did have cops and drunks in The Quiet Man, but that wasn't all they were. And they said, my mother said it was a huge deal, and to see John Wayne playing an Irish, returned Irish immigrant was just stunning. It would be the equivalent of, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Who's big now? I don't know who any big movie stars are. Pauly Shore playing.
Pauly Shore is not big. Let's
he's
all
still know if he is still. We saw that documentary Biodome. You know, I mean, that was good.
But, '90s.
Did you just say a documentary?
Yeah.
Biodome? I thought that was not a documentary.
Not everything I say is going to be entirely true.
Oh, okay.
But it was a huge deal, The Quiet Man, because it showed a representation of Ireland. But unfortunately, it was a blinkered, and even at the time, outdated representation of the country. So, I mean, as I've often said, it would be like us going to America and being surprised that there are no cowboys. You know?
Well, and there are cowboys.
Well,
you just
have
to go to the right places.
Not if you go to, you know, to Manhattan. You're not gonna expect to see a sheriff and saloon doors and all of this stuff, you know?
It would be
awesome.
I'm sure there's a theme bar in New York
bar in New York that totally has saloon doors and a sheriff, and it's probably all full of gay men.
How can you say such truthful things?
But you know what? And actually, that's a kind of funny thing, because in New York, you know, the St. Patrick's Day parade famously has an issue with having representation of gay people, either Irish or American or whatever. But in Ireland, there's no such issue.
No, we don't care. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was actually another giant controversy about that in the St. Patrick's Day parade in Boston this year as well.
Yeah. It's ridiculous, because in our right here, nobody makes any discrimination on St. Patrick's Day. I mean, the idea is to celebrate.
Just anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody just you have your big parade. Everybody turns up. We have a party. That's it.
Except we don't. I mean, I remember a friend a couple of years ago, shortly before St. Patrick's Day, grabbed me by the arm and said, so are you going to the parade? And myself and Leonie, who's my wife, looked at her and went, no, it never even occurred to us to go, because it isn't that big a deal for everybody. It's only for some people. I mean, I certainly wouldn't be interested in it, but that's just me because I'm a miserable sod. Yeah, maybe.
it has become a huge event now in the country. I mean, the St. Patrick's Day festival, it's an actual festival in Dublin now. You know, there's, you know, a kind of a carnival going on, and then there's the big parade, and loads of people come, and lots of people go to the parade. I'm not a big fan of parades just because the sheer crowds of them. When I lived in Dublin city centre, it was, you know, it just, it, it, it just shuts the whole place down for a while, but yes.
So that's interesting, because that's one of the things I was curious about, not ever having been to Ireland during that time. Here, it's a big deal. Here, well, it's actually pretty funny. In the city of Boston, all of the schools have that day off, but they call it Evacuation Day because... Because in the 1700s during the American Revolution, there was apparently a battle where they managed to drive the British soldiers out of Boston and make them retreat to someplace up in the North Shore. And so they claim that that is what that day is for, celebrating us driving British soldiers in a battle that, like, pretty much nobody remembers. Because they don't want to call it a St. Patrick's Day day off, because then it would be not American and... Yeah. Catering to a specific culture, when actually everybody knows it's for St. Patrick's Day, so that everybody in Boston can have that day off and go and drink beer and wear green. But I didn't know how much that would actually sort of translate over into Ireland. So it actually is a big deal there?
Yeah, it has become. And that's new, really. I mean, actually...
Yeah.
I mean,
so what about Halloween? Because I know that that's supposed to have its roots in Irish tradition. Do you actually do big Halloween stuff over there?
It's not the same as the States. Yeah, exactly. Because Ruth, your kids will obviously do a lot of Halloween things in school, yeah?
Well, they're off school now. They're on half term. But, I mean, the schools now have their half term full in and around Halloween, I think, to get them all out of the school, but the last week has been crazy with them dressed up and heading in. My son, who is now 13, got the bus home the other day from his new school for the first time and freaked out because someone got onto the bus in full zombie makeup and sat behind him, and he said he couldn't sit there. He had to go downstairs and sit on the bottom of the bus because there's an awful lot going on. And then, it sort of ties in with the clocks going back. It gets darker earlier, and then Halloween falls, and they're all out in the dark, and it's creepy and scary, and it's great. I mean, it's a really fun time of the year for them. And we used to have a lot more fireworks and everything. I think the downturn in the economy has done us that small mercy, at least, that we don't have the amount of fireworks, because I used to live... On the north side, not inner city, but a little way out. And it was like Beirut. It was like a war. You could smell cordite in the air with the number of fireworks going off in the week before Halloween.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm afraid that actually hasn't changed.
No, where you are.
The only reason there are no fireworks going off at the moment is there's a large Garda presence in the area due to other incidences.
Yeah, fireworks but are normally illegal at the moment in Ireland.
Let Gareth finish his thought there. Sorry.
I just wanted to ask really quickly, because I have never heard of fireworks associated with Halloween before. Is that a tradition?
Gareth, do you want to answer that?
I'd say tradition in that it's been going on for a number of years. I would not necessarily name it as a long-term tradition. I mean, we would have large bonfires and similar things, and I know when I was growing up, we had little sparklers, which were great. You'd have the little thing and you'd wave them in the air. But, I mean, Halloween has, I think, changed a lot in Ireland due to outside influences, like from American television and movies. So it has been changed. So we've exported the idea and then have taken back in some of the ideas that other people have had on it. So it is one of those things that's changed and interacted with various things. For example, did we not used to use turnips for our pumpkins instead? Yeah. Now it's everywhere, it's pumpkins.
Turnips and Swedes. Mm.
I like pumpkins
and
better.
Much easier to carve.
Yeah, much easier.
And they bake better in a pie.
Yep. Mm. Yep.
And as we established, we all love pie, so.
Especially pumpkin.
Oh god, yes. I'm sorry, Ruth, you wanted to say something.
I think the fireworks thing a lot comes because without having fireworks without a proper license for them is actually illegal here. Not that it stops anyone, I think, but it's, I think this is something that comes in from the UK because of, Guy Fawkes Night is the 5th of November. And that, that's a huge fireworks and bonfires thing. And, I think that sort of has come in, through the north, in here, down here, and from people who live there and come back, so.
Well, okay, so, something we haven't talked about yet, and kind of get us back to talking about, SF proper, who would you all recommend as some of your favorite Irish or expatriate writers, as the case may be? Like folks that you think are worth checking out. And yes, I know, Michael, you're gonna mention, you might mention yourself. That's okay. you can mention Ruth and Maura too. That's okay.
So where do you get this idea that I'm an egotist?
I don't know. I am the egotist.
I would definitely recommend Ruth and Maura's work because they are phenomenally good writers and very entertaining people all around. Well, who else would I recommend? Well, I do recommend Michael Scott, of course, the Irish creator of the Nicholas Flamel series of New York Times best-selling novels. There's so many. I mean, in terms of comic books, there's a lot of people now. There's Will Sliney, of course, is doing tremendously well. Stephen Walsh? Is it Stephen Walsh?
Mooney,
Stephen Walsh. There's a lot of really, really strong names. But I don't know, in terms of novels and such like that, who isn't us, who's good? Maura, you jump in.
Well, Owen Colfer, whose work has done really well. I mean, in the sort of young adult, younger market, there's tons and tons of people. And then there's Celine Kiernan, sorry, I had about 10 names in my head and they all left as soon as Michael handed over the mic. But C. E. Murphy, who writes, is an American living in Ireland now, raising her family here. And, she writes kind of urban fantasy novels. If you're looking at just at spec fic, you're looking at as well, Sarah Rees-Brennan, who's actually just moved to London, actually. So she's departed the land for a while. There's Michael, of course, who he's not talking about, himself very much. Derek Landy, Oisin McGann. There are so many of them. And I think we were talking earlier, the last time, is that maybe there isn't a perception that these people are Irish outside of Ireland, because they're very big and they're internationally sort of famous, you know? It's kind of an interesting thing that the identity of Irish isn't attached to them sometimes, I think.
Interesting. Well, what about you, Gareth? Do you want to add any names to the list?
They were quite thorough in going through my list of people. So I have a couple of newish authors who have a small number of books out who I think are worth watching out for. There's a lady by the name of Catherine Farmer who's done a very interesting book set in Dublin, which is one of my interests, is urban fantasy books in Dublin. There's also a lady by the name of Susan Connolly, who's got one book out now, but has actually really done a really interesting analysis on gender and genre fiction that Clark's World published earlier on this year, or a bit of last year. Other people to keep an eye out for is a guy called Paul Anthony Short. He's got a trilogy of books set in New York, and he's also got a new series that's actually due out on Halloween. It's a good day to come and bring a book out, isn't it?
We missed Padraig O'Gillon, actually.
Yes, he was. Yep. That was actually my last name on my list, honest.
Mm-hmm. He's the last name on everybody's list.
No,
the reason he was last on my list is I'm really bad at pronouncing his surname. I just, whenever time I
really
see it,
hard
I get it
wrong.
You can just imagine how hard it would be for people who have never seen it before. Yeah.
Which is why you'll be getting an email from me to make sure I have spelled names correctly.
Yeah.
That sounds like a good idea.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to jump back to comics because there's some really great people working in the field, which, you know, Michael's mentioned some of them, including Michael Carroll himself, because to write for Judge Dredd in 2000 AD is quite the honor, and very few writers are actually given that privilege. So I always think people know Michael a long time in Ireland, I think sometimes they take him for granted, you know. But anyway, there's also Declan Shabley and there's Jordi Belair and Ruth Redmond. And then there's an incredibly vibrant indie comic book scene in Ireland, you know, with a plethora of great names who are up and coming, like Leanne Hamilton, Anthea West, Darren O'Toole, Maeve Clancy. I'm actually stumbling here because I've got such a range of names to draw upon, because there's been quite an incredible renaissance in comic book writing. It isn't a medium that has a tradition in Ireland really at all. But now we've really run with it in the last, it's been building over the last 20 years. But it's now taken off in the last sort of 3 to 5 years.
Excellent.
Well, yourself more as well. More of a queue who's writing for Dark Horse. Let's not forget that. That's quite big when you think about it. I'm jealous. That's how you know how big it is. My level of jealousy dictates how big it is. So yeah, well done.
Excellent. And we're running a little bit short on time because I unfortunately have to go to a doctor's appointment. But I did want to make sure, Ruth, if you want to add some names there before we close out.
Well, I think everyone has covered just about everyone. I don't think we mentioned Kate Thompson.
No.
Last of the High Kings and White Horse Trick and books like that. And we mentioned Celine Kiernan right at the beginning, I think. Mm. Those would be people I'd add. I think they're terrific writers.
Perfect. Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah. And you know, we have, there's a great new animated movie coming out because we haven't really talked about film or television, or we don't have, again, a very long tradition there, but Song of the Sea will be coming out in the US in early December, and everything that's looking about that film looks like it's going to be terrific. It's by Cartoon Saloon, and they have they also put out a previous film called The Secret of Kells, which was nominated for an Oscar. And this film, from everything what I've seen, sounds like it's going to be winning lots of awards. And it's based on kind of Irish folklore tradition. It's about Selkies.
Awesome. So, all right. So let's close this out by getting you all to tell us a little bit about where to find you. If you've got a new book out, that'd be a good time to mention it. Gareth, I know you don't have a book coming out, but you know, there's still time. So, you know, you just get on that. All right. But we'll start with you, Gareth, and I'll just go to the right from my screen. So Gareth, thanks again for being a part of this. And if you could just let people know where they can find you, and also the website for the Dublin bid, that would be great.
Okay, so basically to find me, you probably just want to find octacon.com, which is the convention I'm currently majorly involved in running, and the Dublin bid is dublin2019.com. I think that's reasonably easy to remember.
That's so hard, I don't know.
Well, you can put it in the show notes, right?
Yeah, I will. No, I'm just kidding. Perfect. And you have a Twitter. You want to let people know your Twitter?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I have a Twitter. It's at OMEGAR24.
Perfect. Awesome. And thank you, Ruth, for joining us. And want to let people know, I know you have a new book coming soonish. You might want to let people know that and maybe where to find you on the internet.
Is out.
Is it out? Oh,
yeah,
it's out.
It's a crack in everything. And she gave me a copy at WorldCon. It's great.
Oh, well, then
it's another scary fairy story. So especially if I had found these books when I was a teenager or like 12 to 15, they would have been my favorite books ever, because I was really interested in Ireland, and they're very much set in Ireland, with modern teens that kind of slip into dark fairy world, and it's terrifying. And then there's also romance. It's pretty much everything I would have loved at that age, and I still enjoy them now.
Well, perfect.
Oh, thank you.
A Crack and Everything is out, and I believe that's out from O'Brien Press, correct?
It is, yeah. It came out at the beginning of September. So the second book in the series, Hollow in the Hills, when I finish writing it, will be out next year, around about the same time. And yeah, it's about more scary fairies, and it's set in modern day Dublin. And I'm having great fun writing them.
And where can people find you?
I'm online, a lot of my time. I'm on Twitter as RF Long and my website is rflong.com.
Perfect, perfect. And I'll switch over to you, Michael. Thanks for joining us, and want to let people know if you've got anything come out and where people can find you.
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. I'm available online at www.michaelowencarroll.com. That will link then to all of my many other websites and such. What do I have coming up? A few more Judge Dredd things coming in 2018 in the Judge Dredd magazine in next coming months. Two books published this year. Again, all my websites, but what else have I got? Oh, I've got a Facebook thingy and a Twitter thingy, and they're all linked to from my website. Oh, and a Tumblr thingy, though I still don't know what it's for. I'm sure there's a purpose behind Tumblr, but I don't get it.
Fair enough.
I'm old and know these things, you know. I don't know these things.
And thank you, Maura, for joining us, and want to let people know if you've got anything coming out and where to find you.
Yeah, thanks. It's been great fun. Yes, I've just finished the run on the Witchfinder comics. It's a 5-issue miniseries that was released by Dark Horse Comics in the Mike Mignola Hellboy universe, as I mentioned, and it's called The Mysteries of Unland, and issue 5 just came out last week, so you can get all 5 issues in your local comic book store. I have 2 collections published in the US. One's called Twisted Fairy Tales, so if you like your fairy tales dark and nasty, that's something to check out, and another one called Twisted Myths, and they're kind of large hard book, highly illustrated collections, so they're nice to give as gifts. you can get me on splinister.com, that's my website, and my Twitter is splinister as well, and again, if you just Google Maura McHugh, I usually hit in the top rankings, I think. So you know, if you don't know how to spell splinister, you'll figure it out. And all my various sites, Facebook, Tumblr, all of that stuff is all listed from my first page.
Perfect, perfect. Well, so thanks everybody for joining me, for also rescheduling after my mishap. I really appreciate it, everyone.
No problem.
And thank you, Julia, for being my co-host.
Yeah, sure.
So yeah, that's it. I'm gonna end this very awkwardly by saying awkward ending and scene. And we're done. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.